John 20, verse 11. But Mary stood weeping outside the tomb, and as she wept, she stooped to look into the tomb, and she saw two angels in white, sitting where the body of Jesus had lain, one at the head and one at the feet. They said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said to them, "Because they have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." Saying this, she turned round and saw Jesus standing, but she did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom do you seek?" Supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned and said to him in Hebrew, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Jesus said to her, "Do not hold me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father. But go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Mary Magdalene went and said to the disciples, "I have seen the Lord." And she told them that he had said these things to her.
I was trying to think what I might say to some of you who are new to Sunday Night today to explain what we try to do in this hour, which goes so quickly. You will find, if you come and are new to Sunday Night today, that we are enthusiasts here, and you'll find all sorts of Christians, like the New Life Group, who believe they have found in Christ the real answer to the problem of life, meaning of life, and so on. So you're bound to find that, and it would be strange if it were not so. But I was thinking only yesterday, I hope that you won't find anything over simple, over glib, in our presentation of the Christian faith. It's always easier to say what we're trying not to do. We're trying not to do that. I thought of that yesterday because I was down in Brighton yesterday morning, and I went into a health food shop to buy some absolutely delicious honey that is only in that shop, and which I'm very fond of. And I was given, as a free gift with the honey, this little booklet, a corgi book, called The Magic of Honey by Barbara Cartland. And I was told that my honey entailed honey selected specially by Barbara Cartland, Israeli orange blossom, soft and deep, passionate, elusive like love. Australian light amber, gay, ecstatic, and free as boundless horizons under a sunlit sky. That's exactly how some preachers preach, you know, lifting you all up, and you wonder really whether they're taking you in. And then she tells us in the chapters that honey is good for love as well as health, beauty, nerves, happiness, specific complaints, slimming, and many other things. And, well, I have read Christian books rather like this, you know, who give the impression that there's magic in Christianity, which is the answer to every problem, that no difficulties in being a Christian, by trying to avoid that. You know, this is how it finishes. Stop press on honey. Sir Alec Rose stocked Lively Lady with honey for his round-the-world, year-long voyage. Eros tipped his arrows with honey, believing it would spark off true love. This is top press on honey, mark you. The British athletic team trained on honey for the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico. I'm sure you didn't know that. Write to Mrs. Monica Lee Armitage Court Sunny Hill, who has a really good honey anti-wrinkle cream. I'll give you her address afterwards. Now, I'm sure you know that kind of mini-book, which is thoroughly oversimplified. And one of the things we do hope not to do on a Sunday night at 8 is to give that kind of oversimplified view of Christianity. We believe that Christianity is a marvelous life. But it's true to say, as a friend of mine said to me a little time ago, it does set some new problems as well as solving old problems. And knowing Christ, being in touch with God, certainly puts you into situations that a selfish person might want to ignore. So I hope that we're not that on Sunday night. We usually study a passage of the Bible, and we're doing that this time until 9 o'clock, but before that happens, we're going to pray together. So let's be silent for a moment. I think it's difficult for people on those red seats over there to kneel. People here may like to just do what you like, or remain seated, which perhaps is less noise and so on. But if you don't feel like praying yet, if you're not yet a Christian, then you may like to sit quietly a while. Those who are Christians, follow me as I pray. So, a moment of silence. O God, many of us have come to know you as the living God through our Lord Jesus Christ. And as thou art alive today, we pray that thou wilt be present with us and take the ordinary words of the speaker and make them full of extraordinary meaning to some here tonight. Make the truth of Jesus Christ real and relevant for us. Lift up our hearts to him, open our minds to him, turn our wills to him. And may this half hour we spend together be with profit to us and be pleasing to thee. We ask it through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. Now, if you take the little New Testament in your pew, I'd like you, if you will, to follow. We're going to turn again to John chapter 20. And what we're doing on Sunday night at 8 in full term, this summer, is to go through what is to me one of the really exciting passages of eyewitness testimony in the Gospels. The two chapters in which John, writer and apostle and follower of Christ, describes the resurrection and what happened immediately afterwards. And we looked at the first part of John 20 last Sunday, verses 1 to 10, the story of the empty tomb and the discovery that the tomb was empty by Simon Peter and John, the young man. Now we come to the second part of the story, verse 11 to 18, story that Ian Harrison read just now, the story of how Jesus appeared to Mary Magdalene. This is actually, I suppose, one of the most beautifully told stories in the New Testament, and it's quite impossible to do it justice. I said to Ian just now, don't try and dramatize this story as you read it, because I think you would need to be a Sir Laurence Olivier to be able, indeed much more, to be able to read a story like this and to make it live up to the actual situation, this amazing confrontation with just the name, Mary, and then Rabboni, is an almost impossible lesson to be set to read in chapel or church, I think. It's very interesting that the New English Bible, which seldom leaves well alone, and is usually right to change things, leaves the RSV and the Authorized Version of these few verses almost entirely alone, because it's very difficult, in fact, to translate this in any other way. Simple sentences without any participles. It's as though the writer is just putting down at his very simplest exactly what happens, because he knows that it doesn't need dressing up, it doesn't need any melodrama attached to it. The story speaks for itself of how this woman turned away from the grave with tears in her eyes and found the one she was looking for. Now, we've seen already that this Gospel of John is told very carefully and very selectively. Verse 30 of this chapter says that Jesus did many other signs, which are not written in the book, but these are written that you may believe. And John there tells us that it's his purpose in this gospel to select what he wants to say. He doesn't tell us everything. And so we ask ourselves the question at the beginning, why did he select this particular story of Mary Magdalene outside the tomb to follow the one of Simon Peter and John going into the tomb? And I think the reason is that he wants to give us one story concerning the emptiness of the tomb, and one story about a resurrection appearance, and then having done that, he goes straight on to the consequences of it. Because it was on these two platforms, if you like, that the evidence for the resurrection in those early days rested. The emptiness of the tomb and the resurrection appearances of Jesus to a number of different people. And it's very important, I think, if we're to be fair to the New Testament, to see that these two are always put together and are never seen out of relationship to one another. If you'd simply taught that the tomb was empty, well, obviously, in the last resort, it would be very hard to convince somebody that the body hadn't simply been taken away and put somebody somewhere else. And so alongside the empty tomb, they say, no, he was actually seen by a great many people. If you put these stories of how Jesus was seen by a great many people on their own without the empty tomb, it would be very easy to say this was some subjective phenomenon and this was some vision in the heart and mind of the person. But it's always linked with the empty tomb, as much as to say there's nothing subjective about this. What they saw was what had been in the empty tomb, a substantial body. So these two things are always together in all four Gospels. John puts them perhaps particularly clearly because, as I say, he's writing selectively and with a purpose later than the others, selecting just those bits of material that he wants. Now, I want to start by making some comments on these resurrection appearances in general, and then coming on to this particular instance of an eyewitness account. First, some comments on these resurrection appearances, as they are called in the New Testament. Now, will you keep a finger here and turn to 1 Corinthians 15 in your Bible, that is page 455, and you will see how important the New Testament writers felt these appearances of Jesus, risen from the grave, to be. Actually, 1 Corinthians is one of the earliest writings of the New Testament, about AD 54-55, and he is referring to his own preaching to the Corinthians, which was in early 52 AD, and he says what he preached to them then and on which it was based, one of the earliest records. Verse 3, I delivered to you as of first importance, 1 Corinthians 15:3. What I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, that's Peter, then to the 12, a technical phrase now, of course, because they were no longer actually 12, but the inner band. Then he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, and if you doubt that, while most of them are still alive, though some have fallen asleep, so that you can go and talk to them. Then he appeared to James, and if that was James the Lord's brother, that's all the more remarkable, because the Gospels are clear that the family of Jesus were the very last people to believe in him, then to all the apostles, and last of all to me. It is significant, as we shall see in a moment, that Paul does not mention the appearance to Mary or any of the women, but he chooses these in his writings and says, I want to remind you that Jesus appeared to all these different people at all these different times, and that was the basis of our belief that something extraordinary had happened. All these men, then, were what we call in everyday language first-hand witnesses. I remember at school, one afternoon, we had a thing in those days called the corps. That is to say, you dressed up as soldiers and went running around with blank ammunition. And early in the term, I discovered that my name was not down in the book and that the sergeant major was not going to call me out. So after lunch on those afternoons, I slipped away, caught a bus, and went into the nearby town to the cinema. And one day I was beetling along at the top of the bus, wondering how all my friends were getting along, you know, charging across a field at the enemy who was non-existent, when a car, driven by a woman, but we're not going to talk about that now, crashed into the front of the bus. And I was, as schoolboys usually are, at the top of the bus, which is a double-decker, and of course I could see everything. And the police, when they came, immediately found who were the witnesses. Well, the only witness apart from the driver was myself. Where are you? Well, I said what school I was at, and the next day I was called to the headmaster's study, and there was the policeman. So my initial pride at being the witness was rather brought, well, we won't go on with what actually happened to me, but in view of what has happened this week, let me say that in the days when I was at school before the flood, caning was ordinary, and no local authority thought anything of it, and it wasn't just one cane mark either. Well, there it was. I was a witness, and that's why I had to be called, even though it was the very last thing that I wanted. And we look for witnesses when we want to know what has really happened, and what the apostle is saying here is that real witnesses can be called forth. So that in the New Testament there are a large number of people who can say, I was there. Now, there are only two ways in which we can dissolve this particular testimony. I say this, and this is perhaps the most important part of what I'm going to say about this evidence at this term, because nowadays it's taken for granted, I think, in most circles of people, that there are no very sure grounds for the Christian belief in the resurrection. And I expect you are no different from me in having heard from many people, indeed probably having said it yourself, oh, well, I don't believe all that. As much as to say if there are only a small minority who do believe it, they must be pretty gullible people. I don't believe that, and nor does anybody else really today any longer. Now, many people say that, some sincerely, some insincerely, and I'm not trying to be clever tonight when I say that I'm often tempted to reply, well, you must have a very credulous type of mind. Which, of course, if they're listening to you, causes an instant reaction. What do you mean? You're the credulous one, not me. I'm not trying to be clever, as I say, when I reply like that, because we must be fair intellectually. If you don't believe the New Testament record and explanation of these events, then you must believe the alternatives. You can't just let this hang in a vacuum. And there are only two other explanations. The first is that these men deceived other people and have done so successfully for 2,000 years. And the other is that they themselves were deceived. There is one other actual explanation that's used today. I mention this because I am plagued by spiritualist literature, which comes through my post every Saturday morning. I think I once gave a talk 2 summers ago, and I've received it very, very frequently since then. They're nothing if not persistent. The spiritualist explanations of the resurrection are honestly so puerile that I'm not going to go into them this evening because I don't think that they even need meeting. One of the striking things about spiritualist seances is the platitudes the platitudes that are spoken by those who appear through mediums. And I don't think anybody could say that what Jesus said after his resurrection were platitudes. So let's look at these two for a moment, because if you don't believe the explanation that the New Testament gives to these happenings, then you've got to fasten onto one of these two, and I think if you can fasten onto one of these two, you must be a pretty gullible sort of person. Here's the first. They were deceivers. They lied and invented it. Now, it is very difficult to find any exposition of this by an unbeliever. I haven't had a tremendous lot of time this week to search for one, but so far I've been able to find one. If you can find one, please share it to me. As far as I can make out, in the last 50 years at any rate, nobody has attempted to put this forward as a solution that holds any kind of water. The character of the people involved makes it really psychologically too difficult to swallow. Whatever you may say about people like Mary and James and Cephas, they are not liars in the normal sense of that word. They're not people who go out of their way to deceive. They may have been deceived. That's the much more likely explanation. But they certainly didn't go out to deceive. And if they did, then it is the most fantastically successful conspiracy that man has ever carried out. Because nearly every one of the original apostolic band was put to death, and not one of them split on the lie that they'd done. They preached with sincerity and fire this lie to everybody. They said it would change people's lives and make them good men. And for 2,000 years, at least until, what shall we say, 1870, until the modern rationalist movement, they've managed to persuade nearly everybody in the civilized world that they were right. And that's an exceedingly difficult thing to do. Through the astonishing blindness of many people in this country, because of the old boy net that seems to have gone on around Kim Philby, it wasn't until just a few years ago that that particular traitor was found out for what he was. And yet if you read the book on Kim Philby, you'll find that soon after the war, indeed in the war, a great many of his own personal friends had the deepest doubts about him. So that he managed to take people in only for about 12 years before certain personal friends had these deep doubts that he was indeed a traitor to his country. It's true that he went on for very nearly 30 years, but what a tiny spell of time that is. This conspiracy, a far greater one, has gone on then for 1900 years, and it has been based entirely upon a lie. And incidentally, if they were going to invent it and if they were going to lie, and I'm not going to spend time on this because I think it's boring, it's so obviously untrue, how clumsy to do it this way. I think we must credit John with some intelligence. What an extraordinary thing to do if you're going to select, long after the other Gospels have been written, he's the last of the four Gospels, if you're going to select one witness to the resurrection of Jesus who saw him, would you dream of selecting an emotional woman who was in tears? Nobody would. I think it's the reason why Paul doesn't select a woman in his testimony, is that he knows how easily the man of the world says, oh, that was a woman, she was emotional. You may smile at that, but that's, I'm sure, what Paul has in his mind, not because he's a misogynist, but because he wants people to believe what he says. And then the discrepancies. You know, many of the liberal commentators have gone into a lot of trouble about the discrepancies. There are discrepancies in this story. It's very difficult to know who was with Mary. John doesn't say. The other gospel writers say there were other women. He doesn't. There are lots of little loose ends like this, but exactly what you'd expect if it's a true account. If you were going to make this a lie, you'd see to it that the whole thing was plain done, so that these discrepancies weren't there. And then again, if you were going to have Jesus appearing to any woman, surely the one woman that you would choose is the Virgin Mary. That was the one that would carry conviction. Yes, surely he'd go back to his mother first, but there's no record that he ever went back to her. So if this was an invention and a conspiracy, it's extraordinarily clumsily done. But as I say, as far as I can make out, and I'm open to correction here, in the last 50 years, no writer has seriously put this forward as a possible alternative. We are left then with the one that seems to me to be far the strongest possibility apart from the Christian, and that is the Christian explanation, that is that they were deceived. Now let me say, as truthfully as I can, that I take this particular objection very seriously. You laughed, but it is true in the history of the church and the history of religions that people do have visions, and usually in history it is women who have had such religious visions. And therefore, when people come along and look at the story and see Mary weeping at the tomb, it isn't altogether unreasonable for them to say this is another of the same kind. At first sight, it's a most unimpressive testimony. Now let me, if I may, read you a famous commentator 30 years ago explaining away the angels, which you will see in verse 12. Now, we've had commentaries written for by Christians and professing Christians for about 50 years now, especially in the last 30 years, that have gone out of their way to make it as easy as possible for the unbeliever to believe. Now, this particular commentator is a very great commentator, and he certainly did believe in the resurrection. He's dead now. But it's quite obvious in his commentary that he's trying to put away everything else that could stumble the unbeliever. So this is his explanation of the vision of angels that Mary saw. When men see or hear angels, it is rather to be supposed that an intense interior awareness of a divine message leads to the projection of an image, which is then experienced as an occasion of something seen and heard. That divine messengers were sent and divine messages received, we need not doubt, but needn't we? You see, he now, having dropped it, tries to pick it up again. But I'm afraid completely fails. I don't see that you can say there's any divine message. If this was an intense, I read it again, interior awareness leading to a projection of an image which was then experienced as an occasion of something seen or heard, what he's saying was they were not there. One of the things that university education ought to do is to teach you to be clear and not to do this double think. He's there just guilty of a double think. He wants us to believe there was a message of God, but there wasn't a message from God. Except interior. But if I read verse 12, it's clear to me that John does mean to say that Mary actually saw something. Not interior awareness, but objectively she saw two angels in white. It seems to have made absolutely no impression on her at all. It's one of the remarkable things of the story. She doesn't shriek with ecstasy. She doesn't fall into the ground in a faint. She doesn't rush away and say, I've seen angels. She seems to take it extraordinarily calmly. But at any rate, the plain meaning of the story is that she thought she saw. But you see, that's a very devastating sentence. And when I was first studying theology, it put all sorts of question marks into my mind. Because if the vision of the angels was as interior and unsubstantial as that, well then why shouldn't the vision of Jesus 2 verses later on be just the same? And I can't see any logic to suggest that what you can apply to the angels can't be applied to him. So it may be, and this I think is what the vast majority of intelligent non-Christian opponents of Christianity indeed say it was, an intense interior awareness which projected itself into an experience which was felt to have been had. Let's call it by its ordinary name, a hallucination. So this is quite a good example to take. Was Mary simply suffering from some kind of exalted temperamental emotional feelings which led to a hallucination? Now before we look at Mary for a moment, let's just try and work out what it is that is a hallucination and when they come. And I'm grateful and indebted to Professor Norman Anderson, who has researched into this and has written down the 4 basic facts about hallucinatory experiences. Here they are. First, They are normally confined to certain psychological types. Second, they are highly individualistic. One man's hallucination is seldom another man's. Third, they confirm and focus expected events. And fourthly, they usually occur in suitable places and at suitable times. I think that's very clear and helpful and fair. Let me read this for again, and I want you to think of Paul's testimony, 1 Corinthians 15. Before we look at Mary's testimony, remember what he said? There were 500 brethren who saw him. There was Peter, there was James, there were all the other apostles at different times, and there was myself. And remember then, there were the two men on Easter Sunday afternoon walking to Emmaus. There was Mary here, and a number of other people in the Gospels, including, later on, we're going to see the disciples one morning after they were fishing just before breakfast. Not a time of the day, incidentally, one is normally feeling very hallucinatory. Let me then read these four things in the light of this testimony, which is not confined to one or two people who very much loved him, but to many hundreds, many of whom probably had never seen him in the flesh. First, they are normally confined to certain psychological types. Well, here they appear to men of all sorts of types. Second, they are highly individualistic. But in fact, all these 500 and the other disciples and the others who saw him have only one thing to say, and they're all giving the same testimony. All the more striking because it's rather an odd testimony. They recognize him, and yet he seems strange. He's strange, yet he's obviously the same. Thirdly, they confirm and focus expected events. But if one thing is absolutely plain, it is that the Apostle Paul and the Apostle Peter, and certainly James, the Lord's brother, we're not expecting this. It was the very last thing they expected. They'd given up the whole thing as a failure. In fact, I think it's impossible to find a single person in the Gospels who was expecting anything to happen after the crucifixion, except ignominious retreat. Thirdly, we're told they occur in suitable places and at suitable times, whereas the resurrection appearances happen at the beginning of the day before breakfast, they happen in the evening, they happen on the mountainside, they happen by the river, they happen outside the tomb, they happen in a room, they happen in all sorts of different places and at all sorts of different times of the day. Furthermore, usually hallucinations build up to a climax and then fade away. But in this case, they happen in a period of 40 days, there were none before that and there were none after it. Very short time. Now this is all the testimony of the Apostle Paul in the first place, and Paul of course must have wanted to give this kind of testimony, because I expect when he'd gone around giving his testimony to his conversion on the Damascus Road, that he'd had a tremendous lot of cold water poured on it, didn't you? People always do pour cold water on that kind of experience. So he's well aware of the fact that people need a pretty strong testimony. And in 1 Corinthians 15, as we saw just now, he shows that not just one type, but many different types, saw the same person, they were not expecting it, and they saw him at very different times of different days over a period of 40 days. Were these people then deceived? Well, of course, no one can say you can't believe that. Many people still do. But I can only say that I think the person who believes that all these different characters were deceived and had hallucinations in those 40 days, those people must have a more credulous mind than I have, and that many other Christians have. I think that it is more honest and fair to say that the simple and straightforward explanation of the New Testament is at any rate far, far, far more likely than that, if evidence is something we pay any attention to. But of course most people don't. They've made up their mind before they look at it. Now then, secondly, let's turn back to John 20 and let me make some comments about this particular woman's experience. You cunning man, somebody says, you shifted attention away to Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 when you're supposed to be preaching on John 20 because you know that the testimony of this woman is pretty thin. All right, well, let's be fair and turn back to it. Now, the thing that struck me was the extraordinary originality of this particular account. Let me mention some of the things I have in my notes. Some of them will carry weight with you, some may not. First, it's very early in the morning. Not late at night. She's certainly not keyed up emotionally. She's in the depth of despair. She's cast down. She's weeping. Secondly, I want you to notice that she makes nothing of the angels at all. She sees two angels, so we're told in the story, and they say to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" And without apparently recognizing what is happening, she says, "They've taken away the Lord. I don't know where they've laid him. Will you please tell me?" Extraordinarily banal, isn't it? Extraordinarily sort of commonplace. If you met angels, wouldn't you want to ask them all sorts of questions? But no, she's not thinking of the angels at all. We could have a marvelous question hour with angels, but she's not thinking about that. She just wants this body. She doesn't seem to have taken it in. Saying this, she turned round, saw Jesus standing. Verse 15, Jesus said, "Why are you weeping?" Same question. Who are you looking for? Supposing him to be the gardener. Now, isn't that an astonishing bucketful of ice-cold water in your face as you read the story? I hope nobody will think that this is in bad taste, but the only way I can shock you into realizing what this really means is to take you to a vision which I personally am extremely skeptical about, the vision of the Virgin Mary at Lourdes from Bernadette. Now, supposing in the account of that vision, Bernadette had reported that when she saw the vision of the Virgin Mary, she thought at first that it was the local Mrs. Mopp about her business. Now, supposing she'd said that, people would have hushed it up immediately. We can't have that kind of talk. Nobody's going to believe if you call it, it's not religious. No, no, you saw a wonderful woman dressed like a nun in blue, didn't you? Oh, yes, 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 that's what I saw. That's how these things build up, isn't it? Now, that's just a shocking here, do you see? John just is telling us her impression. She's not here carried away in an atmosphere of prayer. She's not an oversexed teenager looking at a vision in France. This is a responsible woman, worn out with her anxiety, turning around, desperately trying to do the last act of love, and she says, "Are you the gardener? Would you at least be able to tell me? You see, this is a rich estate. Joseph of Arimathea was a rich man. He has his own garden too. And it's natural to find a gardener tidying things up. Well, now, perhaps you can tell me. The angel's not much good." I hope I'm not reading more into this than this. What I'm trying to show is that this is an astonishingly unreligious atmosphere. He's not building up a great experience. It's not all in inverted commas. It's not a purple passage. It's incredibly down to earth. Verse 17. Now, what just happens when, in that wonderful meeting of names and looks, Jesus says to her, "Mary"? She turned and said to him in Hebrew, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Now, something happened immediately then, because in the Greek, Jesus says to her, "Stop clinging to me." So, what is implied between verse 16 and 17 is that the moment she recognizes who she runs to him and falls on his feet and clings to him. "Don't cling to me." Now, this again is completely out of character to the hallucination, the vision type of story with which, alas, the church has so often been saddled in church history. Legends and visions of saints and so on, which have nothing behind them. You don't fall at the feet of a vision and clasp him and find very definite flesh and blood. And then notice the extraordinary message that she goes back with. And haven't you found that the messages that people are supposed to give in visions and so on are so often extraordinarily commonplace and trite? I have, constantly, in reading this kind of literature. But no one could ever have thought of this message. Jesus said, "Don't hold on to me any longer. Stop clinging to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father. But go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Do you suppose in her wildest dreams that Mary could ever have made up a message like that? And she runs back to the disciples and gives them that message. They certainly don't know what it means. So what I'd ask you to see, look at that story for yourself, beautifully told as it is, dramatic as it is, moving as it is, and quite honestly tell me whether you think this is the story of a hallucination, a religious vision, of an uplifted person trying to believe something which isn't true. I get exactly the opposite impression. Here is a person who won't believe it, who won't believe it, and only believes that Jesus is alive, alive because flesh and blood stands in front of her, and the voice, a voice, notice, not just a sight, a voice that she could recognize, calls her name in the way that it always used to do. Now let me try to sum up as we come to an end. What does all this mean for us today? Well, I would put it to you in a way that has helped me very much today as I've thought about it. It means that three things are possible in the world in which we live. First, it means that truth is possible. I think that there are a great many people today, very intelligent people and sincere people, people of integrity, who no longer believe, many people, incidentally, who lecture in universities, who no longer believe that such a thing as truth is possible. Everything now is relative. And this is true even inside the church. Vijay Menon, the Hindu man, businessman, who was converted here some years ago, has an interview with a broadcaster in this week's copy of the Church Times. And the thing that the interviewer is saying to him all the way through this interview is, how can you now say as a Christian that this is the only truth? Surely there is truth to be found everywhere. Now, this is very, very common, isn't it? The answer is that if truth is to be found everywhere, truth is to be found nowhere, and no further on. This man Jesus was not a teacher of timeless truths, as alas he is presented to many of you in school religious instruction periods. If you get back to the Gospels, you'll find that what he is teaching energetically the whole time is himself, as we saw in the sermon Mr. Barclay gave us this morning. Turning to Mary and Martha, the same Mary, he said once before, many weeks before, I am the resurrection and the life. Not there's a life after death, that wasn't his teaching. I am resurrection, whatever that may mean. All his teaching centered around himself. If you want the truth, come to me. You live in a dark world. I'm its light. Follow me, and at last you'll be able to get through the darkness and tread on firm ground. This man claimed to be the truth, and he, in a popular modern phrase, stuck his neck out. He said, I assure you that I am the truth. Man doesn't believe me and he'll put me to death. But God knows that I'm speaking the truth and God will raise me up again. And if I'm not raised up again, you'll know that all I said is wrong. So here is a man who put himself and all his teaching, quite new teaching, the most astonishingly arrogant teaching of its only human philosophy. He put it, so to speak, in front of us and said, if that is true, then I myself will be raised, because I am the truth, and the truth is wrapped up in me, and if I die and die for good and am finished, then the truth is finished. Now that's the Jesus of the Gospels. He wrapped the truth entirely up in himself, so that when he himself was wrapped in the grave clothes and put in the grave, the truth is finished, as far as Christian teaching goes. If he then bursts out of the tomb and is alive today, then at last we have a focus, a reference point, and we can know that there is some truth in the world and that God has spoken. And I rejoice in that myself tonight. I rejoice that as I stand up in this pulpit, I'm not just talking about philosophy as someone in a lecture hall, but that I really am able to bring to you the truth by which we can guide our lives, which is the truth of God. It's possible at last to say this, not because I or the church or any other Christian is clever, but because Jesus rose from the dead. At last there is a reference point for all our intellectual cravings and questions. Secondly, it means that love is possible. Now, all the songs and the talk is about love today, but if death can break a relationship that I have with somebody else, then love is not possible permanently. The relationship that Jesus had with God and the relationship that Jesus had with Mary and the other disciples was brought to an end by death. If Jesus cannot conquer death, then that relationship of love is broken, and that's the most tragic thing in the world. To live in hearts we leave behind is not to die. So you see often in the paper, but it's pure doggerel, isn't it? And it offers no comfort, because if all you do is to live in the hearts of those you leave behind, the relationship is broken. Now what is so marvelously exciting here is this. I am ascending to my Father and your Father. Go and tell my brethren. Do you see? The relationship is still the same. It's not been broken. They're still my brothers. He is still my Father. I am going to him. Far from the relationships being broken, it is restored. And I have a relationship with you, Mary. Death has not been able to stop that. And therefore, no death, your death, will not be able to stop it. It's for good, for keeps. Now, to believe that surely is to believe something wonderful. It's amazing to me that people can throw their hats in the air when they've disproved Christianity to their liking. Because surely if there's one thing we want more than anything else, it is to meet again those we have loved. That's what Mary wanted. Thirdly, it means that hope is possible. Now, again, it seems to me that we live in a hopeless world because death in the end has the last word. And so you get modern playwrights and thinkers saying that death is the only thing that is obscene, that nothing else is obscene except death. I think that's a misuse of words, but we know what they mean. What they're saying is that death comes in and cuts every hope down to the ground. And that if death is at the end of every life, the end of every generation, then nothing that we build really has any point or meaning. But if this story is true that you have in John 20, then not only is truth possible, love possible, but also hope is possible. But I don't know anybody else but Jesus Christ who can offer truth, love, and hope. And he can't offer these unless he rose from the grave on the third day. If he didn't do that, then these things don't exist. If he did do that, then they do exist, and they're within your reach. And that's the marvel of this message. You can have them, you can find them, you can begin to experience them through Jesus Christ. Well, it's just 9 o'clock. Let's have a moment of silence in the last minute or two.